There used to be a political philosopher called John Nabbett, and when he began his lectures, he said, if you want to know what the relationship between my lectures and my book is, the relationship is one of identity. I didn't want just to repeat myself. So what I want to do in this session is think about the kind of theological premises involved in town planning, and therefore in the structuring of social space. You can't do that abstractly, so I've got two concrete examples, but I think we may well not have time to go through both examples, so I may well stop after the first and then get into the interesting part, which is discussion. And let me tell you how I got into this whole area in the first place, because I think that it affects my whole approach to it. When I was working in Scotland, I had a telephone call one day from the person who was responsible for religious education in schools for Glasgow and South District. Now, Glasgow is the biggest city in Scotland. It's been divided since the Industrial Revolution between Protestant and Catholic. But over the past 35 years, there's been a big influx of Hindus, Muslims, Sikhs, and so the schools that he was responsible for included inner city schools. They included lots and lots of areas which were predominantly Muslim or predominantly Sikh, and then they included rural areas in Dumfriesshire where there are more cows than people. And where kids have to be bused to school for many miles in order to make up a quorum. So he said, the government requires all children to have an hour a week or 2 hours a week or whatever it is in religious education. And these days, what that is values education. How on earth do you teach children from such different cultural backgrounds? That was the question. And he said, I want you to come and talk to these teachers and tell them how to do it. So I said, I haven't a clue. And he said, okay, well, it's a challenge to you. And then, trying to think about it, I thought, well, the thing that these kids have all got in common, no matter what religion or culture they come from, is that they all live somewhere. They all are educated in particular buildings. They all walk or cycle or bus to school down particular streets and roads. They all shop in particular areas. What kind of values are implicit in the buildings in which they live, in the streets which they ride down, in the schools that they're educated in? What kind of values are these buildings communicating to them? I've never thought about the question before, and I have no idea how to begin. So there were two bookshops in Dundee, where we lived, and I forget whether I had to go to both, but anyway, I went to one and found Lewis Mumford's book, The City and History, and took it back and read it like a novel, really. I mean, it seemed absolutely fascinating, and began from there. I should say that this chap said to me, come over, we will... give you your travel, and we'll give you a fee, and so on. Well, he never gave me my travel, and he never gave me a fee. But he did give me he launched me on an extremely interesting path of inquiry. And so the project actually began by thinking about ethics, by thinking about values, and thinking at a really fundamental level everybody in society share. That's what I was looking for. And then because my theological teacher is Karl Barth, I immediately then moved from ethics to dogmatics, because Barth says, you can't have one without the other. And so I tried to reflect theologically on this material, not to the school teachers, but later to myself. And I started looking in the tradition and really couldn't find much. Now, some of you here may be able to point me to resources, but the only really explicit text that I found was by Aquinas. And I found that he snitched that from Aristotle and repeated it more or less word for word. He didn't rework it. He didn't rework it in the way that he reworks Aristotle's material in the Summa. And then I went to all the standard ethical textbooks, and we've got all of these familiar theological ethical loci on war, on property, on sexuality, and so on and so forth, on law, nothing, on the Bill of Rights, absolutely nothing. And it stunned me, really, because having once begun to think about it, it seemed so absolutely central to the meaning of human life together, and how can you not reflect about it? What I tried to do then was to read through this literature of town planning, a whole swathe of literature on the built environment, and then try and reflect on it theologically, more or less in the way in which I've been taught by Bart. And that means that what I wanted to do was to put it in some kind of Trinitarian perspective. And I think I think that what the doctrine of the Trinity is for Christians is simply a way of trying to grasp how the God who is the origin and end of all things relates to all things which are not God. That's what the doctrine of the Trinity tries to do. God the Creator is God the origin and end of all things. God the Spirit is, and Laura here has worked on the doctrine of immanence in Celtic spirituality. God the Spirit is, I think, about God's presence to and within all forms of reality. God the Son is about how it is that God engages with that minute fragment of cosmic reality which we call human history. That's how it seems to me. So I wanted to put this material on the built environment into that kind of theological framework. And I think that I haven't succeeded very well, there's lots of opportunity to have another go and try and do it better. And as an overall framework for the built environment, I think I want to say something like this, that God the Holy Spirit, we have this word in our language and shared by many European languages anyway, of inspiration. So I want to say that God the Spirit is that aspect of the divine which inspires all generous, creative visions of a better human future. And I've put up there, this is the first slide, this is the famous diagram of Ebenezer Howard in Garden Cities of Tomorrow, which was published at the end of the 19th century. Now, Howard was a Quaker, quite certainly driven in his concern for producing a better built environment by his religious convictions. You see, what he produces here is a vision which escapes from the industrial city which he knew so well, where everything was drowned in soot, and where people couldn't breathe properly because of the fogs and all of this kind of thing, on the one hand, and on the other hand, what Marx and Engels called the idiocy of rural life, by which they meant the fact that people in the rural areas were so poor, so overworked, that they had absolutely no leisure and no energy for the things which made the fullness of life. So this was Howard's vision of the Garden City, which he thought would bring together the best of the rural and the best of the urban, and would be the future for the built environment for human beings. Now, I mean, one of the examples which we may or may not look at today is a third generation garden city. And the verdict on garden cities is very much out. Lots of people don't think that they were much of an answer to the problem. But so what I want to say in terms of Trinitarian reflection is that it seems to me that when we're talking about the spirit, we're talking about the source of these visions. So when we're dreaming and visioning about the world that we want, as opposed to the world that we have, it's God the Spirit who leads us in that area. And then for God the Creator, I look at Genesis 1 and I see that what the God the Creator does is to bring order out of chaos. In terms of God the Creator, what I want to do is make a theological plea for the importance of planning. Now, planning is one of those things which has got a very bad name over the past 100 years, and Peter Hall, the great writer on cities, published a book at the beginning of the 80s called Great Planning Disasters. And he looked at a whole series of things where planners had simply got it wrong. But interestingly, he measured the way in which they got things wrong chiefly in terms of overspend. Now, what I want to say is that planning is actually one of the central ways in which love takes flesh. Planning is one of the central ways in which love takes flesh. And it's an aspect of the reality of God the Creator in our world. And then, thirdly, we all know that the three great divisions which Paul identified in Galatians 3:28, class, race, and gender, actually take concrete shape amongst us. So class, race, and gender often don't mean much outside of the actual reality which they're given by building. So we went up to Monticello, Jefferson's house this morning, and if you want race and class written into the built environment, all you have to do is see that house and compare the elegant and beautiful spaces for Jefferson and his friends upstairs with the tiny rooms downstairs in which the people who cooked all their food and prepared all their food and made all their furniture lived and worked. And that's true all over the world. Absolutely everywhere. So ghettoization, forcing parts of the community into certain spaces, gendered space, the way in which rooms, parts of the house which were traditionally occupied by women got much less light, were given much less attention than parts of the room which were occupied by men, and so on and so forth. All of these things actually were inscribed in the built environment. And therefore, God the Reconciler is about how we address those injustices, how we address those inequalities, how we get away from the ghetto, what a non-gendered city would look like, what a multicultural city would look like in terms of the built environment. So those kind of things. And that's
my overall framework in terms of Trinitarian reflection. So, as I say, it's not possible to talk about the planning of urban space abstractly. And I've got two examples. And the first one I want to look at, maybe the only one, is Plymouth. You can perhaps just see there that this is the memorial to the sailing of the Mayflower out of Plymouth in 1620. And that is on Plymouth Hoe. Somebody from roughly this part of the world, North Carolina, don't know how far away that is. Anyway, he is, so this is, Raleigh also sailed from Plymouth. So there are connections with this part of the world. Now, Plymouth is not an ancient town. In 1500, it consisted of three little fishing villages on the mouth of the River Plym, obviously, and the population was probably about 1,500 people. And it grew in the course of the war with Spain. So Plymouth Hoe, which is the cliff overlooking Plymouth Sound, is the place where Francis Drake famously was told that the Spanish Armada was in sight, and he said, no problem, we can still finish the game of bowls that we're playing. So that's the historical memory which every British school child learns. So it grew in the course of that struggle with Spain, so that by 1600, Plymouth was about 4,000 people. And then it grew very slowly over the next 200 years, until the time of the Napoleonic Wars. And it was really in that struggle with France through the 18th century, but most particularly between 1790 and 1805, which is the Battle of Trafalgar, that Plymouth exploded. And it exploded around the naval dockyard. So it was no longer a fishing town. It was a town built around the naval dockyard. And it grew as Victorian cities in most parts of Europe grew, no planning legislation. And so buildings and factories and workshops just grew up overnight, all over the place. Until by 1890, there were 230,000 people in Plymouth, and there was 1.25 acres of public space. Okay, 230,000 people, 1.25 acres of public space. And then by the end of the 1930s, that had grown slightly, 240,000 people in Plymouth. And that's where things were. And Plymouth was the main base of the Royal Navy. And that was the reason that in March 1941, Plymouth was bombed for a week by the Luftwaffe. And then, as now, precision bombing is not up to much, and they didn't do much damage to the naval dockyard, but they simply levelled 160 acres of the centre of the city. There were nearly 2,000 homes completely just rubble, and there were 6,000 homes that were damaged. So the mayor of Plymouth at that time was a person called Lord Astor. And he was both an aristocrat and a socialist. In Britain today, we still have aristocrats, but we no longer have socialists. So when I talk to my students about socialism, I have to send them to historical dictionaries to find out what it means. Anyway, Lord Astor got in touch with a buddy of his who was called Patrick Abercrombie, who was the leading town planner in Britain. Actually, I've got a picture of the Blitz there. That was the Blitz. So he was the leading town planner in Britain at Imperial College London. And Abercrombie was busy because he was doing the plan for London after the London Blitz. But Astor leaned on him. And over the next 2 years, he produced the plan for Plymouth, which was brought out in 1943 absolutely beautiful, beautifully produced book. It's quite amazing what was actually produced under wartime conditions where there was no money for anything. And this is on beautiful paper with beautiful illustrations. The most moving of which, I have to say, it moves me to tears every time I see it, really. It took 10 days to put the fires out. And on the 10th day, Asta ordered a dance. So he said, we're going to have a dance on the home. And there's a picture of the citizens of Plymouth dancing on the... Fantastic, absolutely fantastic. Very, very neat. Anyway, Abercrombie was a disciple of two American planners. And both the towns I'm going to talk about actually took their inspiration from American planners. And in this case, the two planners were Lewis Mumford and Clarence Perry. Abercrombie doesn't spell out the philosophy of town planning, which he's working to, but you can work it out by reading the plan. And I think that there are six parts of it. And the first part is Abercrombie wants to design a place which exists for community. And Lewis Mumford wrote a little pamphlet in 1941 called The Social Foundations of Post-War Reconstruction. The Social Foundations of Post-War Reconstruction. And in it he said, we've been misled by individualism. Human beings don't live as individuals, they only live as community. And Abercrombie quotes that, and then he says, I think that we've learned during the war that the individualism which was leading us astray before the war doesn't work. What we need to do is find ways of making community work. Now, the idea he took from Clarence Perry, who advocated what he called the precinct principle. And what you've got there is Plymouth divided up into a number of areas, each of which was going to be the basis for a more or less self-sufficient community. And each of these areas was going to have 6,000 to 10,000 people, at which they calculated was the number of people you needed to support a primary school. And so each of these areas was going to have a church, a clinic, a pub, a village green, recreational space. But then, and this is really interesting, each community must have a hall where the community makes its own entertainment. Okay. So it is Merry England behind this. There's a kind of vision of bucolic peasants sitting out on the green in the evening with their fiddles, having a merry pint and quaffing together, and then, you know, getting together for a dance on Saturday evening. It never worked, but that was the vision. That was the vision. And that was the first thing. So no longer were the 230,000 inhabitants of Plymouth all going to be jammed into the centre, living hugger-mugger with each other, cheek by jowl with industry, but there were going to be these community settlements, and industry was going to be zoned, so that there would be a proper distinction between community and industry. Second thing, this is a long time before Kirkpatrick's Sales book on Human Scale, but Abercrombie already is advocating the importance of human scale. And in the light of our present urban realities, what he says is actually quite, it has a real irony about it. Let me read you this. It's not generally appreciated that it is the community spirit developed from that inherent characteristic of all races in the form of mutual aid
which has been mainly responsible for the development of art and knowledge in the best periods of progress in personal industry, craftsmanship and science. A perversion of this wholesome spirit of community life has driven the human race to congregate together, and despite a natural love of the country, we're still enlarging our towns until now we have 44 towns in the world with a population of over a million.
Okay? So what he would make of Mexico City, Delhi, Beijing, these cities of 20 million or more. I mean, he must be revolving in his grave. But he felt that, and this was something that he took from Mumford as well, that there was a proper limit. There was a limit beyond which human community didn't function. You could have a city of 250,000 people, but if you had that, then break them down into these smaller units within it. Thirdly, given this city which had been bombed flat, he wanted to maximise recreational space. And again, rather beautiful what he writes here. Actually, he's quoting Mumford. "There's not a village or a housing estate that's well planned unless it has made provision for places of withdrawal, solitary walks, devious woodland paths, no less than places where people can gather together in groups for social communion." So what he did was to network the city with little paths, little alleyways, tree-lined, so you could walk right the way across the city on these paths and crisscross them north and south and east and west. And that part of his plan still remains. Then, fourthly, and this is going to be the theme of the talk that I'm going to do on Thursday, he did an agricultural audit of all the land around Plymouth. And he said it would be a crime to build on grade one agricultural land. So he assumed that Plymouth was always going to be primarily dependent for its food on the agricultural land in its immediate environs. So he was prepared to use grade two, grade three, grade four agricultural land. He was absolutely not prepared to use grade one agricultural land. And that, it seems to me, he's hugely foresighted. Fifthly, he thought that beauty was an important part of the built environment. And again, let me quote this lovely, lovely passage from him. "The authors have permitted themselves one great decorative, even monumental feature. Those who today," this is 1943, don't forget, "those who today plan a straight line, such as an avenue in a park, and place something attractive to look at the end, are in danger of being called vista mongers. The authors of this plan are not afraid of this label. They have boldly planned a vista from the station to the hoe, not a Renaissance road, but a garden vista, a parkway, making use with terraces, slopes, steps, pools, avenues, and often contrasting features of the varying levels. It affords a pleasant break in the shopping precinct and an open space to the civic group." So, Abercrombie made a number of mistakes, and I guess that you know, it's just part of the planning process that you're bound to make these kind of mistakes. He thought that people would always arrive in Plymouth by train. And what he wanted to happen was to raise the embankment on which the train arrived, so that when you stepped off the train, you looked down this garden vista straight to the hoe. And he wanted a monumental feature framing the hoe at the bottom of this garden vista, so that you looked down, your eye was caught between these two things, and you knew where you were. This was where Francis Drake fended off the Armada. This is where you'd come. So you had a sense of place as soon as you arrived in the city. That was his idea. And the last thing that he wanted to do was to tame the motor car. Now, At present, in the United Kingdom, 3,500 people a year are killed by motor cars. Before World War II, it was 6,800 people a year. More people died in road accidents than died in the Blitz. And Abercrombie was one of the planners who wanted to address that problem. And so he pioneered the idea of the inner city ring road. He wanted Plymouth to be a pedestrian precinct area. So that lorries and things delivering goods could come in early in the morning, but then they'd clear off, and people would be able to move around.
Well, Heidi quotes T.S. Eliot in her book quite a bit, The Hollow Men, 1925. Between the idea and the reality, between the motion and the act, falls the shadow.
This is Abercrombie's lovely plan. So here we have the sea, and this is the garden vista that he talks about, and here would be the station, and you'd get out, and then these are the pedestrianised streets which people would shop in. And there's the statue of Sir Francis Drake on the Hoe. This was going to be the Railway Hotel, which Abercrombie wanted planted with palms, because he said Plymouth is a southern town. So you come from the smoke, you come from the fog and grime of London, and you get off the train and you see palm trees, and you know you're in the West Country. And this is what actually materialised. So this is his garden vista. And there are two problems with it. So he wanted streets which would rival the streets of Nash and Younger Wood in Bath and Regent Street, which are, you know, very beautiful, if slightly pompous and pretentious streets. And what he got was lots of pre-stressed concrete. There was no money. There was no money to do the fancy stuff that he wanted. So this is Plymouth today. The idea of his monumental feature. And so you would look down and your eye would go through those two things to the Hoe, and this is what you've got. So that monstrosity on the right is the council buildings. There are more of his beautiful buildings, and this is the inner city ring road here. Now, in his plan, Abercrombie had underpasses, so nobody would actually have to cross, but the city couldn't afford underpasses. And so ever since this was all built in 1947, the citizens of Plymouth have always been leaders in the marathon races in the UK, because it's basically you line up at one side, and as soon as you hear the bleeps for cross, you belt for all your life, and only the fittest survive. This is one of his settlements, Ham Common. Here's your village green. They've all got a village green like this. And there are the shops, the Ham wine store, you can see there. What you can't see, what the photograph doesn't show, is that a lot of these places are boarded up. Mm-hmm. They simply hadn't worked. That's a church on Ham Common, actually rather a nice church. That's the pub, an extremely grotty pub, absolutely terrible. And that's the green, that's the recreation area, rather, in Ham Common. You can still play football and so on that. But these are the houses. These were the houses which were put up in the early 1950s. They're prefabs, prefabricated. And this is one of the mistakes that Abercrombie made, because the prevailing weather in Plymouth is southwesterly. 351 days of the year, let's say, there's a southwest wind blowing rain in off the sea, and these houses all have so much condensation that everything rots inside. So they're deeply uncomfortable and they're extremely difficult to redeem. And if you go back to his grand streets, in the old Victorian Plymouth, there was not much space, but there were narrow streets. And so when the Southwesterners came in, you could always duck under cover. There was always somewhere to go for cover. There were awnings which you could get under. But in these streets, there's nowhere to go for cover. And so, you know, if you're a Plymouthian, A, you never know where you are, and B, you're always getting wet. He's a great man, but even great men make mistakes. So that's Plymouth, and the six principles: community, human scale, maximised recreational space, agricultural land, beauty, taming the motor car. Well, the precinct principle fell apart because, of course, again, something that Abercrombie hadn't quite worked out. Once the generation which staffed the primary school grew up, the roles in the primary school just plummeted. And how could you keep it going? He didn't allow for social mobility either. It hasn't been possible to keep up that community. Secondly, television became universal in Britain in the early 1960s, and nobody knew what to do with these blooming halls. They were just white elephants. So this idea of the community supporting themselves and providing all their own entertainment just didn't work. Human scale, of course, in Europe, there's tremendous pressure of population, and Plymouth is absolutely bursting. So it's now 300,000 people, and they've had to build on Abercrombie's Grade 1 agricultural land. A lot of the recreational space has gone as well. This idea of somehow or other maintaining the human scale hasn't proved feasible. In terms of beauty, they're stuck with these concrete buildings from the 1950s. The city is trying to regenerate itself, but one of the problems with the built environment is that if you make mistakes, it's incredibly costly to go back and redo the whole thing. And where's the vision going to come from? So the city has been grappling with this now for the past 15 years. And there are lots of people who want to pull down that inner space and replace it with something different, but nobody yet has come up with a cogent plan for what that will be, or the money to do it either. And as I said, the motor car hasn't been tamed. How are we doing for time?
We're doing well. I think we're doing fine.
Would you like me to go on to the second example?
Yes. Shall I go on to the second.
Okay, this is Milton Keynes. Milton Keynes is roughly in the middle of England. If you come west from London, 50 miles you get to Oxford, and if you go north from Oxford, 30 miles, you come to Milton Keynes. Milton Keynes is built on a mistake. When the Labour government took power in 1962, they were persuaded by some population gurus that the population of Great Britain was going to increase by 20 million before 2000. Okay, it actually increased by about 6 million. But they bought the idea that it was going to increase by 20 million. And where are we going to put them all? And so they sequestered 49 square miles of agricultural land in the middle of England to become a new garden city. And they created, they had to do that, they had an act of parliament, and they created the Milton Keynes Building Corporation, And that corporation took 3 full years to consult, to think about the kind of city that they want. And again, an American planner was the leading inspiration, and this time he was from Berkeley, Melvin Weber, he of the non-place urban realm. And Weber got one thing right and one thing disastrously wrong. So he said, what you've got to do here is attract industry, and it's not going to be heavy industry, it's going to be light industry. So it's going to be services, and it's going to be electronics and this kind of thing. And there, he's been absolutely vindicated. And Milton Keynes has been staggeringly successful in attracting business to the new town. Unemployment in Milton Keynes is 1.5%. In a country where some cities have got an unemployment rate of 11%. These, by the way, are concrete cows. They're a joke throughout Great Britain. When the city, to recall the agricultural past of the city, you have concrete cows. Now, the raison d'etre of Milton Keynes was housing, and so the city actually began with housing. They built a lot of the housing before they put a single brick in place for the centre of the city. And what they did for the housing was to section off areas of about a square mile and invite applications from architects for designs. And so Milton Keynes is the product of many hands. About 30 leading architects produced designs for Milton Keynes, some outstandingly successful and some disastrous. And this is one of the disasters. This is an area called Netherfield. And it's just fascinating in terms of the impact the physical space can have on a population. Because this is all new housing, it's from the beginning of the 70s, and it's the seventh most deprived estate in Britain. And these grim modernist houses have proved completely unlettable, unsaleable, nobody wants to live in them. The estate is riddled with problems, and they're now using European community money to put pitched roofs on them so that they make them look more like a conventional house, in the hope that people will finally want to live in the place. There you are, Netherfield again. This is a more recent, this is a 1980s development in Milton Keynes, and the whole city is characterized by very low density. By and large, in Milton Keynes, there are about 30 houses to the hectare, that's 2.5 acres, which certainly for Europe is very low density, and you've got a suburban city. You've got a suburban city. Now, you take a place which has got no history and has got no story. How do people orient themselves? How do they find their way around? The people who put up this particular development had the bright idea of putting an obelisk here. And when you go to the obelisk, it doesn't mean anything at all. It's just an obelisk. It doesn't commemorate anything. But they thought, well, people remember it and they can find their way around by orientating themselves around this thing. So there's a real problem with lack of story. And so, of course, Milton Keynes is very, very slowly and over the course of the years beginning to acquire a story. But what the planners faced here was the situation of just having a blank sheet and trying to put a story in place. And that really proved extremely difficult. Now, when they got to the centre of the city, they finally faced the question, what on earth is a city for? What's it about? Why should we have this place? Other than simply expanding suburbia, what makes this place different from, what makes it a city as opposed to an extension of suburbia? And there was a tremendous argument which ran for about 5 years between the chief planner for the county in which Milton Keynes is situated, which is Buckinghamshire, whose name was Fred Pooley, and Melvin Webber and his disciples. Because Fred Pooley wanted a light rail network in place round Milton Keynes, which would be 10 minutes from every house. So everybody would be within 10 minutes walking distance of this light rail network. The light rail network would run 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, and it would just slow down at these halts and you'd hop on, and it would take you into the centre of town. And Melvin Webber said, that's a thing of the past, it's much too expensive, everybody's going to live out of their car, so what you've got to do is put in roads. And unfortunately, his argument won the day, and there you have an aerial picture of the centre of Milton Keynes, which is dominated by the car. And it had the first shopping centre in Britain. So the very first thing that they built in the centre was a shopping centre. So what's a city about? Well, it's shopping. Yeah. Okay, now that's not entirely wrong, because cities have always been about markets. But this was the way in which the meaning of the city was articulated. It has a shopping mall. There it is, there's a fountain in the middle of it. And they kept one of the old trees in the field there. It's now sponsored by Barclays Bank. I don't know how a tree is sponsored by a bank, but anyway, there it is. And then of course, people can't just shop. They also need things to do. So what do they have? They have leisure. So this was the second thing. So the city is first of all about consumption, and secondly about leisure. Now that thing in the middle of England is an ice slope. So you can go to Milton Keynes and ski down the ice slope. Quite extraordinary. It also had the very first multiplex cinema in Britain. That's it, believe it or not. These were the two things that first defined the city, consumption and leisure. Then they started building the municipal buildings. Until 5 years ago, there was no building in the whole of Milton Keynes more than three stories. What they've gone for, you may possibly remember the name of a British Prime Minister called John Major, mm-hmm. who was the archetypal grey man. Well, this is kind of John Major architecture. It's a John Major version of architecture. So it's just excruciatingly dull. And this is how Milton Keynes has been defined, with these huge roads made for lots of cars. The one building which has any individuality in the whole city is a church, which is there it is, Christ the Cornerstone in the middle of Milton Keynes. And that, I think, is just a shocking mistake and a shocking failure. Not that there's very good work that goes on in the church, but you see, I don't know who the architect was, but it was somebody who knew nothing about the church and didn't bother to find out either. City church, must be St. Paul's, okay, you've got like a dome, must be neoclassical, stick it up, okay, and that's it, and that's what a church is. So the architect simply hasn't thought about what church in a contemporary city might be and might want as its form of space. Just tremendous missed opportunity, that. The one thing that Milton Keynes has been really successful with is in its preservation of Greenland, but that's because the city is built on floodplain. And so there are a series of rivers which run through it, and at the moment they're proposing building on this floodplain. They're building on floodplain all over Great Britain, and the insurers are actually refusing to insure some of these schemes. But at the moment, Milton Keynes still has lots of these green areas for this particular reason. Okay. If we think about the success and failure of Milton Keynes, one of the things that the Milton Keynes Corporation was pledged to do was to consult. So they were supposed to consult the citizenry, but of course this has never happened properly. What has happened is that every few years a little sheet has gone round, tick here, and then with a thing at the bottom, what would you most like? And the answer is cheaper rents. So they haven't had any kind of creative feedback. The most interesting development in Milton Keynes is that they've realised that building the city for the car was a complete mistake. And so these great boulevards are now being widened, and they're building higher density housing on them to try and recreate or to engender for the first time the vibrancy which goes with being a city. Okay, let me try and think about what we might learn theologically from these two examples. First of all, the priority of life together. Advocated by Abercrombie, denied by Melvin Webber, is that something that we ought to underwrite? And if so, how do we do it? Now, interestingly, in the various little settlements in Milton Keynes, there's one which was designed by Norman Foster, which has been outstandingly successful. It's called Bean Hill, and the houses that he put up had movable internal walls. And so as families expanded and contracted, people were able to alter the shapes of their houses to accommodate the new domestic arrangements that they had. And Bean Hill has become, against all Melvin Webber's predictions, an outstanding community area. So it's got its own folk club, it's got endless community associations, and people are queuing up to live there. And people are proud to be part, not of Milton Keynes, but of Bean Hill. So you have to ask yourself the question, what's the secret of success there, as opposed to the failure of somewhere like Netherfields? And can we learn from those kind of successes and failures? And it seems to me theologically that we are committed as Christians to the priority of community, to the priority of life together. Of course, it's absolutely right, as Abercrombie recognised, that people need to be able to get away, they need spaces for seclusion, they need to be able to be solitary. But the basic principle is not individualism, it's community. So that's the first thing. Secondly, when Abercrombie drew up the plan for Plymouth, he didn't consult at all. And the reason that he didn't consult at all was that he didn't want speculators to get in and push up the land prices. The Milton Keynes Corporation was committed to consultation but never really did it. Now, it seems to me that the story in Numbers 11 is really a key story for our understanding of community. You remember, it's the story where Moses feels that the whole burden of leadership is too great for him, that he just can't cope with all the strains of leading this people Israel. And Yahweh says to him, I never asked you to, you know, try a bit of consultation. Why don't you share out the burdens of it? And so Moses elects or gets 70 elders elected, and the spirit falls on them. And then you remember that there are the two elders, Edad and Medad, who are outside the camp. And the spirit also falls on them, and the 70 elders are really indignant and says, you know, they've not been to seminary, how on earth can they prophesy? And Moses replies, would that all the Lord's people were prophets. And so it seems to me that key to the success of life in community has to be some kind of successful empowerment. So people have to feel that they own the space. So another example, or a successful example of that, happened in a rebuild in Newcastle on Tyne, where the architect went into a slum area and lived in a cabin there for 9 months and invited the local people to come into him and say, what do you want? And if they weren't articulate, he said, here's a piece of paper, draw what you want. And tried to build what they wanted. Now that housing development, which is known as Biker Hill, has been outstandingly successful. It looks very odd. People like it and they feel that they own it. So empowerment, ownership, a sense that this comes out of the community resources and is a response to people's own sense of aesthetics and of values. Thirdly, the question of human scale. What is it? Now, I think that question is put really sharply by Milton Keynes, because I used the word vibrancy, and it seems to me that in a city, as opposed to a suburb, there really ought to be, you know, a tremendous sense of bubbling life, of vibrancy. And so what I'm forced to ask by Milton Keynes is, you know, if you take New York, you might say, this is all totally beyond human scale. These are vast buildings. They overpower us. But do they? I mean, what is human scale? And so I think that that's a debate that we have to have. What is Babel reaching, towering to the sky and inappropriate? And what is actually a failure of imagination a real failure of nerve, which lacks something truly human, which is what I would say is true of Milton Keynes. Fourthly, both Abercrombie in his prioritisation of Grade 1 agricultural land, and Milton Keynes in its preservation of the floodplain, it seems to me that we cannot build successfully if we have an anthropology which thinks of human beings as masters and possessors of nature, as Francis Bacon put it, masters and possessors of nature. Because if we think like that, then we're bound for disaster. And so, theologically speaking, when we're planning for community, it seems to me that alongside Galatians 3:28, we need to put Romans 8. We need to insist on the fact that, as humans, we are part and parcel, bound up with the whole of the rest of creation, and insist that, you know, that has to be respected if we're not going to walk into disaster. Lastly, I think that we learn from this whole process of planning that whereas in abstract philosophy you can divorce ethics and aesthetics, so you can have a critique of practical reason, and then you can have a critique of aesthetics. You can't do that with the built environment, so ethics and aesthetics go together. And so human beings respond to beauty as flowers respond to the sun. Beauty is not simply an optional extra. It's actually part of shalom. It's part of proper human flourishing. And if we don't have it, then, you know, our spirits just droop. And there's something which God has ordained for us, which is missing. So it seems to me that those are five things which theologians will want to contribute to the discussion about how one might plan urban space. To me, it seems that town planning, the planning of urban space, is actually essentially a form of ethics. It's actually about making practical moral decisions which affect human life. And there's a conversation about ethics which comes from every great human tradition, which comes from the philosophers, David Properly, which comes from town planners, which comes from the technologists, which comes from engineers and builders. But in that conversation, church also has a voice. It also has something to say. It represents a long rumour of wisdom, to use David Ford's phrase. It represents a long rumour of wisdom about what it is that is proper to human flourishing. And it seems to me that one of the things that we have to do as church is become much more active in debates about the kind of urban space that we're going to have and what we ought to do with the urban space which we already have than we have conventionally been in the past. Thank you for your attention.